Hello again, everybody, and welcome to this Off the Deaton Path podcast for December 7th. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and welcome you to our podcast this week. We are recording today from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Swift Enterprises, where we have been given specially made earplugs to get through the podcast. Got several things you want to talk about this week, some big things that we'll get to. We'll start with just some history in the news items that I like to bring to your attention, something you may find interesting. The Library of Congress, first up, has brought many of its collection of the papers of Abraham Lincoln are now online in full color and high-resolution images. The library holds, as you would imagine, a huge collection, over 40,000 Lincoln documents that it has, dating from 1774 through the Lincoln presidency and beyond. This includes materials from his campaign, the first and second inaugural addresses, the earliest known copies of the Gettysburg Address, correspondence with his wife, members of his cabinet, military generals, other key figures, all kinds of Civil War correspondence. Much of this is now over 20,000 original documents in the collection have been digitized as high-res images through a collaboration with agencies in Illinois, and you can go online and take a look yourself at loc.gov. The Lincoln papers came to the library in 1919. They came through Lincoln's oldest son, Robert Todd Lincoln, who inherited the papers after his father was assassinated in 1865. And the collection has only been open to the public over the last 70 years, first opened to the public in 1947 at the end of a moratorium period mandated by Robert Lincoln. So go online, check those out, loc.gov. While you're there, you can check out a recent acquisition that the Library of Congress made. They acquired the Codex Quetzalcoatzin. Now say that five times fast, and you say to yourself, what is that? Well, it represents one of the most important indigenous manuscripts from the earliest history of America to become available in the last century. This has been a private collection for more than 100 years. It has now been digitally preserved and made available online for the first time to the general public. Again, go to loc.gov and check this out. One of the most important indigenous manuscripts from the earliest history of America to become available in the last century. And my colleague here at the Georgia Historical Society, Elise, checked this out online, said it's beautiful to look at. So I commend it to you. Go online, take a look at it. Finally, if you're a fan of the Harry Potter books, like my 11-year-old daughter, who can't get enough of them, you would be interested to know of a recent auction. A new world record was set for Harry Potter, a first edition that was sold at Bonhams Fine Books and Manuscripts in London on November 15th. This was the first edition of the British edition of the first book, which was called Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone by J.K. Rowling. This was auctioned off in London for £106,250. And you can do the math yourself on the currency, what that would be in dollars. It had been estimated at going for anywhere from £30,000 to £40,000. This book was inscribed to a friend and her family from J.K. Rowling. The inscription is dated 1 month and a day after the book was published on June 26, 1997. It was one of the first copies supplied to J.K. Rowling by the publisher, and it sold at auction for £106,000. Don't you wish you had the foresight to know what is sitting on the shelves right now in first edition at Barnes & Noble that you could go get for $15 that might be worth that much money 20 years from now? New world record for a Harry Potter first edition. We turn now to recent passings. I like to keep you up to date on some of the people who have died recently, historical figures or otherwise, that you probably didn't see that I find interesting. First up is Bobby Doerr. Bobby Doerr was the Hall of Fame second baseman who played for the Boston Red Sox. He played 14 seasons, and you think, okay, baseball player. But Bobby Doerr was the oldest living former major leaguer. He was the last surviving major league player from the 1930s who was still alive. He died on November 13th at the age of 99. Now, Bobby Doerr was born on April 7th, 1918. World War I was still going on. Woodrow Wilson was president, had a long, long life. He was a nine-time American League All-Star. He won just one American League pennant in 1946. Of course, the Red Sox went many a long year without winning a World Series. He was never on a World Series team. But Bobby Doerr was indeed a Hall of Fame second baseman. He died November 13th at the age of 99, and his death leaves Red Shandiest, best known for his years with the St. Louis Cardinals, as the oldest living Hall of Famer at 94 years old. On November 7th, Paul Buckmaster died. He's an arranger, a musical arranger, and you may or may not know his name, but you certainly know the music that he has worked on. He did some soaring orchestral arrangements. If you've ever heard Space Oddity by David Bowie, you've heard Paul Buckmaster's work. If you're an Elton John fan and you listen to Your Song, if you heard Moonlight Mile by the Rolling Stones on their Sticky Fingers album, if you heard You're So Vain by Carly Simon, you heard Paul Buckmaster. He was 71 years old, was still working up until the last few years. Elton John wrote on Twitter after his death, "He helped make me the artist I am," called him a revolutionary arranger who took my songs and made them soar. Buckmaster rarely gave interviews, but one thing he said, and I want to quote, one general rule is to hold back as an arranger as much as possible, to give the listener the chance to let the song grow and unfold, introducing new sonic elements, such as new instruments or sectional groupings. If you use everything from the beginning, you have nowhere to go. So many of his arrangements were heavily reliant on strings. So you can hear this on Carly Simon's You're So Vain, as I mentioned, the Rolling Stones' Moonlight Mile. So much. I remember having Elton John's albums in the early 70s as I was growing up, and I saw his name on all of his albums. Tremendous influence on 20th century music. Paul Buckmaster died November 7th at his home in Los Angeles. He was 71 years old. Finally, a death much closer to home here in Georgia. On October 15th, Cornelia Walker Bailey died. She was the matriarch of the history of the Geechee community on Sapelo Island. I had the pleasure of knowing Miss Bailey personally, visited her at her home many times through the work we did here at the Georgia Historical Society. We hosted many summer institutes for college teachers through the National Endowment for the Humanities. And we would often go and take tours of Sapelo Island, many of them given by members of her family. She would always host us for lunch at her house. She was a joy to be around. She was a living legacy of the freedmen, of the enslaved community of the island, the freedmen community that survived after the Civil War. She spent her life trying to preserve Sapelo Island's saltwater Geechee community. And in 2001, she wrote her memoirs. You can still get them on Amazon. God, Dr. Buzzard, and the Bolito Man, a saltwater Geechee, talks about life on Sapelo Island. Her death was noted in The Economist, on NPR, on New York Times, and she will be missed in Georgia, and she's really a piece of American history. Cornelia Walker Bailey died at age 72 on October 15th. Rest in peace, Miss Bailey. And now for our time capsule. Today is December 7th, and of course, 76 years ago today, the attack on Pearl Harbor that began America's entry into World War II. We all know about that. I want to tell you about something else that happened 100 years ago yesterday that you probably, I'm guessing, never heard of. December 6th, 1917, the Halifax explosion. This happened in Halifax, Nova Scotia. In the harbor, the SS Mont Blanc, a French vessel, carrying high explosives, nitroglycerin, TNT, 20 barrels of high explosives, traveling without a red flag, which vessels carrying high explosives were supposed to carry, collided in the harbor at Halifax with a Norwegian ship, the SS Imo, I-M-O, in the Narrows there, and it started a fire on board the French ship. Well, the sailors on board that ship, of course, knew what they were carrying, knew an explosion was likely. They abandoned ship. The ship caught fire, and for over 15 minutes, it drifted in the harbor before coming to rest against the pier along the Halifax shore. Now, imagine, I'm sitting here in Savannah. There's a large port just north of here on the river. So imagine if a ship catches fire on the Savannah River, the number of tourists and people who live and work in Savannah who would gather both on River Street, but anywhere within a half-mile radius to see what was going on. That's what happened that morning in Halifax. Thousands of people were on their way to work or were already at work at jobs on the harbor. many people looking out the windows of their homes. School children were looking at all at this ship burn, or they had simply gathered down on the dock to watch it burn when the explosion happened. It exploded at 9:04 in the morning. As you can imagine, shrapnel went everywhere. And this wasn't just an explosion. This was the biggest explosion of the pre-atomic age, the largest man-made explosion before the development of nuclear weapons. How big was it? Well, instantly, 1,600 people, 1,600 people killed instantly, 9,000 were injured. Of those, 400 later died, 2,000 people killed in this explosion. You can imagine what it did to the city of Halifax. 12,000 buildings destroyed. 6,000 people left homeless. Created a tsunami. There was all kinds of flooding. How loud was it? Sailors 150 miles out to sea heard the blast. On land, people 300 miles away felt the jolt. The shockwave demolished everything within a half-mile radius. Now, I want you to think about that. That's like having an explosion in the North Georgia mountains, and we feel it down here in Savannah. The shaft of the Mont Blanc's anchor, which weighed over 1,100 pounds, spiked into the earth more than 2 miles away. That's how big this blast was. As I mentioned, a tsunami was created by the blast. It wiped out a Native American community that had lived in the area for generations. The forward gun on the Mont Blanc, which was a 90 millimeter, blew off the ship and landed 3.5 miles away. The shockwave from this blast traveled through the earth at 23 times the speed of sound. A tremendous explosion. Did unimaginable damage. Of course, it sent metal and shrapnel in all directions. Windows shattered. And inside homes that weren't destroyed, remember we're talking about 1917, many homes, even with electricity, if they had them, were still cooking with wood-burning stoves, oil-burning lamps. Many of these inside in houses were overturned. Whole city blocks turned into infernos. Halifax residents, remember now, this is in the middle of World War I. There were Halifax residents who thought the city was under attack from the Germans. That's how bad this was. One of the great stories, and you know, we know from our own experience, September 11th and other days of disaster, there are always stories of great heroism that come out of these days. One in Halifax, and there were many. You can imagine the rescue efforts that had to go on. It started immediately. People just trying to make sense of what had happened. Bodies everywhere. Body parts everywhere. One of the great stories to come out of this disaster was an Intercolonial Railway dispatcher named Vince Coleman. No, not the St. Louis Cardinals second baseman from many years later. Vince Coleman was a railway dispatcher working at the rail yard 750 feet from Pier 6, which is where the Mont Blanc finally landed. He and a co-worker were there. Sailors were running past him, screaming at him, telling them they needed to evacuate. The ship, loaded with TNT and nitroglycerin, was on fire and was going to blow. So he and his colleague from the railway fled the scene. But Vince Coleman remembered that an incoming passenger train from St. John, New Brunswick, was due any minute. He turned around, ran back to his post, and telegraphed a message that was heard by all the other stations along the Intercolonial Railway. His message said, and I quote here, "Hold up the train. Ammunition ship afire in the harbor, making for Pier 6, and will explode. Guess this will be my last message. Goodbye, boys." Unquote. His message stopped every incoming train, including the passenger train from St. John, New Brunswick. He is credited with saving the lives of 300 passengers. He himself was killed instantly. You can imagine the chaos going on all over town. No one knew quite what had happened. The suffering, the screaming, unimaginable. This was like a scene from hell. The next day, while efforts are going on, 16 inches of heavy snow fell, which really hampered rescue efforts. The last body was not recovered until the summer of 1919, a year and a half later. Now, many of the most devastating injuries were eye injuries. There were a lot of people looking through window glass that shattered when the explosion happened. So many of the health reforms that came out of this, there are always reforms, hopefully, out of any tragedy. You may remember the hotel fire in Atlanta. in the 1940s, and the sprinkler systems that are now in use everywhere in high-rise hotels came out of that. Well, the same thing happened in Halifax. There were health reforms that came out of this tragedy, especially regarding eye care, pediatric care, because many of the injured were children. The legacy of this thing continues to this day. For years afterwards, the explosion was the standard by which all other large explosions were measured. When Time magazine in 1945 reported on the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, it said that the bomb was 7 times that of the Halifax explosion. People remembered that. To this day, trees that survived the explosion have been cut down, are still found to be filled with shrapnel, and sawmills to this day are very reluctant to take wood from the Halifax area because of the damage the shrapnel embedded in those trees can do to the sawmill blades. And in Halifax today, on the south side of the clock tower of Halifax City Hall, the hands are still frozen at 35 seconds past 9:04 a.m., the time of the explosion, and the waterfront holds a slab of the anchor of the Mont Blanc. The Halifax explosion 100 years ago yesterday, December 6th, 1917. And finally, to end our podcast, I want to just mention some random thoughts about the college football playoffs. We found out last weekend the 4 teams who are going to be in the college football playoffs this year. 3 months ago, we surveyed the college football season, what was likely to happen. Alabama is in the college football playoff. Well, everybody could have predicted that. Clemson is in the college football playoff. I think everybody thought within reason, them being defending national champions, despite the loss of Deshaun Watson, that they would be back. Boy, Oklahoma's in there. They look good. The one team nobody saw coming in September in the college football playoff was the University of Georgia. Go Dogs. We were hoping that Kirby Smart's second year would be a good one. We didn't realize how quickly he would get this team back into the conversation of the national championship. And really, thanks to Nick Saban, every SEC team now wants to be in the national championship conversation. It's not enough to win 8 games. It's not enough to win 9 or even 10 games. Everybody wants to be in there. We've seen a slew of firings across the SEC this year. Tennessee, Texas A&M, Arkansas, Florida, looking for head coaches. And I can tell you, at the University of Florida, they're not going to be satisfied going 10-2, been losing to Georgia and somebody else every year. They want to be in that conversation. Some controversy, of course. Bama is in at the number 4 spot over Ohio State. The University of Alabama did not win the Western Division of the SEC, much less the SEC. They didn't even win their division, and yet there they are. How do you think Auburn feels, having beaten number 1 Georgia, having then beaten number 1 Alabama? Yes, they got beat in the SEC Championship, and here they are playing in the Chick-fil-A Bowl, watching Alabama play for a national championship. That's how it goes in college football. In my opinion, they still haven't gotten this right, and I don't know that they ever can until they open up and have a real tournament. One time many years ago, someone suggested seeding the teams at the end of, after the conference championships are over, seed 1 through 16 and have a tournament. Have 1 play 16, 2 plays 15, and so on. Well, college presidents will never go for that because it would extend the college season well into January, maybe into February, and their, quote, student athletes, it would just be too much to ask them to do. So, to get in now, you almost have to have a perfect schedule to get into the college football playoffs versus the NFL, where, let's face it, a 9-7 team, right? A team who loses 7 games can get into the playoffs, and the NFL playoffs, just like the NBA and the NHL, and even in Major League Baseball now, it's a tournament. You may be the best team in the regular season and go nowhere in the playoffs. In college football, that doesn't usually happen. Again, a 9-17 can go to the Super Bowl if they get hot at the right time of year. So all these other teams now go to bowls. There are so many bowls. I don't even know how many there are, but there are more bowls than there are good teams. As we all know, everybody struggles to win 6 games a year against quality opponents so that they will be, quote, bowl eligible. The downside of the college football playoff, it has made some of these bowl games not just irrelevant, but silly. My argument is that games in bowls should be at least as interesting, if not more interesting, than many of the games played during the regular season. And if you turn on a bowl at any point over the holiday season, over the next 3 weeks, chances are it will not pique your interest in the least. And I use one example, nothing against either one of these schools, But this probably wouldn't excite your interest during the regular season, and it probably is not going to when you see it. The Quick Lane Bowl. Yes, there's a Quick Lane Bowl. It's played in Detroit at Ford Field the day after Christmas on December 26th. Duke is playing Northern Illinois. I dare say, even if you're an alum of one of those schools, you're probably not really interested in this. And as a college football fan, you cannot imagine ESPN showing this game and their 7:30 slot during the regular season. I don't know what's going to happen in the college football playoffs this year. Of course, I'm rooting for Georgia. I think they're going to give Oklahoma a very good game. For the first time in 75 years, Georgia is playing in the Rose Bowl. For the first time in 59 years, Clemson is playing in the Sugar Bowl. And for the third year in a row, Clemson's playing Alabama. This is a great rivalry, and undoubtedly, these will be great games. I will end with one thing, and you can say you heard it here first. This is a prediction. If and when Nick Saban ever decides to leave as the head coach of the University of Alabama, it will obviously be one of the most coveted jobs in all of sports, one that carries more pressure, arguably, than any other coaching job in college football. My prediction, the next coach in Alabama will be Dabo Swinney, the coach at Clemson right now. Why? Well, Dabo was on the national championship team in the early 90s. He played under Gene Stallings, so he's got that pedigree. He is a Alabama alum, and even though Nick Saban's not, Nick Saban had great pedigree when he got there. Dabo Swinney will have played there on a championship team. He will have coached on a championship team at Clemson. He is from Alabama. He is tailor-made to be the next Alabama coach. Now, you may say, look, he doesn't need to go to Alabama. He doesn't need to go to Alabama. He is at a top-flight program right now at Clemson. Absolutely true. I'm still going to make the prediction. Dabo Swinney will be the next Alabama coach, and you can say you heard it here on Off the Deaton Path first. We recorded today from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory of Swift Enterprises, where the hustle and bustle all around us never bothered us. Our producer today has been Chow Winkler. As always, if you have any complaints about the show, up to and including the sound of my voice, or anything we talked about, any complaints, please send those to Chow. Any good things you have to say about this show or about life in general and how well it's treating you, please send those to me at sdeaton@georgiahistory.com. Our mailman this week and every week, staggering in under the load of the mail we receive here, is one Gary F. Taylor, born and raised. That's right. Our legal counsel this week and every week is provided by the law offices of Gallipo and Taylor, where their motto is, you're not cured until they're insured. Our caterer this week is Hagee's House of Tacos, home of the Drippy Enchilada. All beverages provided by our friends at the Dros Brewery, where their motto is beer, because that's what your right hand is for. Our engineer this week and every week is the hardest working engineer in show business, Brendan Cannonball Crellin. You can find out everything that's going on at the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com. Check it out. And the upcoming Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. You can now find our podcast at Google Play, if you have an Android, and at the Apple iTunes Store and the podcast app, if you have an iPhone. Please tell your friends and family about it, because after all, why should you be the only one who's miserable listening to this? And you can find my blog and other similarly painful podcast at offthedeatonpath.georgiahistory.com. We'll see you again next week. So long, everybody.